And I do see that counsel is present for the 230 docket, and you are the same counsel for both cases, I understand. All right, and what I'm thinking of is, because you have the half hour for each argument, 15 minutes aside, and what I'm thinking, if we could first address the 2004 order. Does that make sense? The 2004 35C order, I believe that's the case 893-08CA.
Right.
So if we could address that appeal first, and we'll do half hour argument if you need it, and then we will proceed on the second appeal. I know they're related. All right, just one moment. So I'll just clarify again, it's just 15 minutes aside for each case. All right, and I know counsel have been here before, so you understand our timing system. If anyone has come in since the 130 docket, if you have any cell phones or any phones that would make any noise or anything, please turn those off so it's not to disturb the argument. And when counsel's ready, then we're ready to proceed. All right, this is People versus Bobby Gilkey.
Good afternoon. I'm Allison Ruttenberg, number 17497. I'm a counsel for Mr. Gilkey on both cases. And I apologize in advance. I've been under the weather with the flu for the last week, so I apologize if I'm not quite 100% here. The reason why I asked for oral argument in these cases, you know, usually we don't have oral argument in these denial of Rule 35C without hearings unless there's something unusual going on, is because procedurally these cases got so messed up and it got so confusing. And when the Attorney General asked for the 08 case to be dismissed, arguing that Mr. Gilkey would be fully protected by then a remand hearing on the issue of whether Mr. G was ineffective and in for his failures in properly perfecting the appeal, I just wanted to clarify, because I think that is confusing the issues. The 08 case, remember, is the denial of the 04 order. So it's the second appeal is actually the denial of the first case, which makes things very, very confusing, because it was perfected years after the fact, after he had filed his second 35C, and then that had been denied. The first 35C, he filed a pro se 35C, and then Ms. L was appointed and she filed a supplemental 35C. And while some general issues were raised regarding ineffectiveness of Ms. Bass, or Ms. B, the direct appellate counsel, who has since had a published decision when she was suspended, kind of the gravamen of that first 35C dealt with alleged ineffective assistance of trial defense counsel, Mr. S, in particular regarding all of these identification issues and whether he should have called an expert witness to properly assess the scene. Just kind of let me back up a minute. Factually, what happened here, there was an armed robbery at the Safeway, and then supposedly these two defendants, sometime later, the cops were never in hot pursuit, but at some time later, the cops are alleged to have started chasing them and only succeed in arresting one of the defendants. My client is alleged to have gotten away, and he wasn't caught for another 7 or 8 years. But there were two distinct crime scenes. There was first Safeway, and then there was the shootout that happened several hours later after a delay when the police were not in hot pursuit. And so the police that were originally at the scene of the Safeway were not the police officers who were chasing these two defendants sometimes later. And the attempted murder charge arose because supposedly my client got in a shootout with these police at the second crime scene. My client claims he was never at the second crime scene. He has no idea what happened there. There certainly is a huge discrepancy in the witness testimony as to the identification of these gentlemen. Either they completely changed clothes and completely changed hairdos and mustache styles between the robbery and the shootout, or there was another defendant involved, or the policemen were mistaken in their identification of the witnesses from that of the eyewitnesses at the robbery, because there's clearly all of this conflicting testimony between what they were wearing at the Safeway versus what they were wearing at the shootout, and then the physical description of the defendants, whether they had afros, whether they had jerry curls, whether they had bad skin, clear skin, mustaches, what height they were. Certainly that raises an issue as to whether there were different people involved.
So to cut to the chase, with respect to the 2004 order, which is the subject of the 08 appeal, what is it specifically that you're claiming that counsel did or didn't do that amounted to ineffective assistance with respect to these identification issues?
Well, the gravamen of that 35C was failure to have a ballistics expert to analyze the scene of, you know, the second crime scene where the alleged shootout took place, because there was all of this conflicting and contradictory testimony that at least the defendant alleged in the 35C doesn't make sense, that the way the police officer testified what went down in the shootout just doesn't make any sense, given the location of the shotgun shells. And then, remember, there were as many as three preliminary hearings. Mr. Finney was arrested at the second crime scene, and he's alleged to have been the defendant's co-defendant throughout.
Well, it's more than alleged. He's convicted of it, right?
He pled guilty to it.
Right. And may I ask another question? In addition to Mr. Finney having pled guilty to it, the officer Heaps apparently stopped the right car because the money from the robbery was in that car, right?
Right.
So the issue here is not really Mr. Finney or the car. The issue is whether the person in the car with Mr. Finney was your client.
Exactly. Whether Mr. Finney was in another car with another defendant at the time he was apprehended at the second crime scene, given that
the witnesses at the robbery described a white Cadillac.
Right.
In fact, that's what Officer Heaps pulled over, is the first white Cadillac that drove by him on I-225, and that Cadillac led him on a chase eventually to the place where there was the shootout. But we've got a white Cadillac at the crime scene at the Safeway, right?
Right.
And we've got this white Cadillac, and then we've got the testimony of a witness saying, "Yeah, I loaned Gilkey and his buddy the Cadillac, right?
Right.
And it was the Cadillac that the cops stopped, right?" Okay.
But the question, at least in my mind, is did someone else get in the white Cadillac?
I understand. I just wanted to make sure I was right about those.
Exactly. There's a huge discrepancy in identifying the second defendant, in other words, my client. And there was a lot of conflicting testimony at the various preliminary hearings than with what happened at trial. And I don't know what happened at the first preliminary hearing, because that I'm not even sure it was ever even transcribed, because Mr. Finney then pled guilty. My client wasn't arrested for another 7 or 8 years. Then at the second preliminary hearing, which was the first preliminary hearing for my client, the eyewitnesses at the Safeway store testified in person. And she apparently had she admitted to having a great deal of difficulty in identifying my client. First she picked someone else out of the lineup, then she picked another person out of the lineup, and then only on the third go-around did she pick out...
Is that what she said? Didn't she say, look familiar, takes about a minute and 38 seconds to go through, and then at the end she says, pointing to Mr. Gilkey's picture, I'm 99% sure that's him. Isn't that the way it went down at trial?
That's the way it went down at trial, but when you look at her testimony, well, we don't have her testimony from the second preliminary hearing, but when you look at the attorney's summary, she's very confused as to being able to identify Mr. Gilkey. Or there certainly was more impeachment material available had trial defense counsel either obtained first trial defense counsel's notes, who was the trial defense counsel at that first preliminary hearing, or called a witness to testify in rebuttal to, I'm going to butcher her name, Ms. the witness at Safeway, the one, Ms. Witzke, to contradict what she said at the second preliminary hearing versus what she said at trial. So then the gravamen of the Rule 35C was there were three basic issues that I laid out in my brief. Let me find them really fast. That he was ineffective at the third preliminary hearing for not calling Ms. Witzke herself, rather than let the summary of her testimony come in, given the fact that she testified at the second preliminary hearing, and at least that attorney took very specific notes of what she said.
She testified at trial?
She testified at trial.
Right, and just to clarify, so with the preliminary hearing issue, are you saying that by failing to have her testify at the third preliminary hearing, that counsel was prevented from impeaching any trial testimony based on the preliminary hearing? I'm trying to understand the...
Well, the problem is there's no transcript of the second preliminary hearing where she testified. So in order to preserve her contradictory statements, she needed to have done one of two things. He needed to have either called her in person at the third preliminary hearing to get her to repeat what she said at the second preliminary hearing, or had gotten the first attorney's notes from the second preliminary hearing, or called that attorney to testify what she said at the second preliminary hearing so she could be impeached at trial.
So I understand that was one of the grounds alleging ineffective of trial counsel. And then
right.
The two other grounds which you're raising on appeal that were raised in the motion was that trial counsel failed to litigate a motion on destruction of evidence. And then the other one was failing to call an expert on ballistics.
Exactly.
And I just wanted to clarify from the record, in the post-conviction motion that was subject to the 2004 order, the one we're discussing now, there was also an additional issue about ineffectiveness of appellate counsel in that motion. But that's not being raised in this appeal.
Right, because what happened was Mr. Gilkey raised that in his pro se 35C. Ms. L., the first post-conviction counsel, did not litigate that and appears to have abandoned it. So in Mr. Gilkey's second 35C, he's raising ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel for failing to properly raise and preserve all these various issues of appellate counsel's ineffectiveness, given her mental health issues that were then raised in the subsequent proceedings before the Supreme Court that were available by the time he had post-conviction counsel. So then what happened was the district court in 2004 didn't make findings of fact and conclusions of law. It just issued a one-sentence denial of this 35C, basically saying for the reasons set forth in the DA's answer, I'm summarily denying this 35C without hearing. And it's a contention of this appeal that for all the reasons, you know, set forth in my opening brief that he was entitled to a hearing to litigate these issues, to present expert testimony, the ballistics expert, a legal expert, regarding whether trial counsel fell below the standard of care, so he can make his record as to whether there was prejudice or not. I mean, the DA is basically asking the district court to just look through the transcripts itself and conclude that, and then the district court didn't even do that. It didn't even make the findings of fact and conclusions of law that the district attorney in his response said that the district court could make without identifying what they were, and then the district court didn't make any, which is reversible error. And it was reversible error not to have the actual evidentiary hearing so Mr. Gilkey could put on his case of prejudice, that, you know, go through all of the transcripts and show that his conviction was not a foregone conclusion, that there were various issues that could have been raised by trial counsel that weren't raised that could have called the result in question. Instead, the DA does what they do a lot and say, well, asking the court to find prejudice is just speculative because you never know. But if that were true, then no defendant could ever prove the second prong of Strickland, and that just isn't true.
Let's take, the allegation as to the ballistics expert. What is the theory of prejudice here? The allegation is you didn't call, the trial counsel didn't call a ballistics expert. And so what's the theory of how and why that prejudiced the defendant, recognizing that nobody's making any findings of fact, but there has to be a theory as to what would the ballistic expert have said, at least in theory, that might have affected the outcome of the trial?
That given what Officer Heaps was saying happened, and given the fact that there was no gun and no shells ever found, that couldn't have happened.
Well, excuse me.
Or that it didn't happen.
Okay. I understand making that claim, but the only evidence that I can find in the record of the weapon that this person who shot at Officer Heaps was a witness at the grocery store who said that the person with the gun had a six-shooter revolver. There would be no shell casing in that instance. Second, behind Officer Heaps was apparently a field. And third, in front of Officer Heaps was apparently a garage, and his bullet was recovered from the garage. So why would a ballistics expert say it couldn't have gone down that way?
Well, I mean, I think Mr. Gilkey's biggest concern here is that there was this witness at Safeway who tied him to this gun, but then there was no gun recovered at the scene, and Officer couldn't testify that he testified that somebody shot at him. I mean, there's this disconnect as to whether Mr. Gilkey, I mean, if there was a shootout at all, which Mr. Gilkey denies, whether he was even there for it or whether someone else was there. So, I mean, I wasn't 35C counsel who wrote this motion. So, I mean, I can't manufacture stuff, but I, you know, if I had the opportunity to go back now and litigate this, you know, I think I could make a better record to at least show plausibly that what Officer Heaps is saying happened can't be tied to Mr. Gilkey, that at best you can tie that to some scenario that happened between Mr. Finney and another person.
Thank you, Ms. I'm sorry, Mrs. Ruttenberg. Your time is up.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Corral Spedigue, attorney registration number 39208, and I represent the people in this matter. As we are all clearly aware, this case is a procedural mess. We have an instance where one defendant, admittedly for a seemingly good reason, has initiated two appeals in the same district court case challenging what amounts to be essentially the same order. Now, I say that because in the one instance, we're challenging the order directly, and in the second instance, we're challenging the right to appeal that order, more or less. Now, because in my briefs, I recommend that the court would like to separate the cases out, but the way that I see it, these two cases are kind of inextricably intertwined. And so I'd like to take a minute to explain to you what I think is the best course of action and why. So if you'll give me a moment, because there exist so many irregularities at every step of the defendant's proceedings here, the people would submit that our main concern should really be to return this case from this procedural hyperspace that it's in right now, and to do so in a manner that offends the least amount of appellate rules, post-conviction procedures, and established appellate rules as well. That being said, the people think that the best course of action would be to work backwards. Essentially, we're fighting over whether or not we should send everything back in a big mess, you know, hullabaloo, or if we should do this in a little more organized manner that I believe would serve the best interests of this court and the defendant. Now, by dismissing the 0893 case, and I would submit that we should reverse this court's order of July 23rd, 2008. That order found the defendant's notice of appeal to be timely filed almost 4 years out of time. Now, although the people recognize that this court has the discretion to reconsider its own prior rulings, as it did in this case, for purposes of disentangling the unique circumstances that are present here, I feel that we would submit that accepting the defendant's late notice of appeal went against the November 04 order and the January of 05 order, where this court said, knowing the circumstances, being fully aware of the fact that, you know, the defendant's appellate post-conviction counsel failed to perfect his notice of appeal on time, but still declined to take the case and declined to take any further action. It's noteworthy that the defendant at that point did not seek any certiorari review, and that then instead he pursued another proper remedy, which is to file the second 35C and then pursue his avenues that way. So I believe that his remedy should now be allowed to flow from the second 35C motion and from the appeal in that motion. So if you'll forgive me to kind of postulate a little bit in that direction, if we were to just consider the 1304 case, 07 CA 1304, the appeal of the second 35C motion, then we would leave those remaining issues for resolution. So the district court in that case denied the 35C as untimely and found no justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. I would submit that this court should consider the fact that that court erred in finding so, because it's not that it was, although in my brief I agree that it was untimely, I've actually had, you know, a second look at this again, and it seems that the post-conviction appellate counsel claims and the post-conviction claims are not untimely because they were likely raised within a reasonable amount of time, which I believe is the standard when reviewing. It's outside of the 3 years. However, he could not have raised those claims prior. And so clearly, you know, he did that within, I believe it was 8 months that he raised the second 35C after being denied the appeal. And that seems to the people to be a reasonable amount of time within which to raise those claims.
Ms. Fettigy, I was going to ask you about that with the idea of a time bar when you are raising ineffectiveness of either post-conviction or appellate counsel. So do you have any authority or any guidance for the reasonable time?
No, it seems like the law is a little conflicting at this point. All I could find was that a reasonable amount of time seemed to be what the standard is. I can find some case line if you'd like a supplemental. I'd be happy to file one. But at this point, you know, there wasn't any hard and fast rule. It just seemed to be whatever was reasonable, and the people would be willing to concede that we believe 8 months would be a reasonable amount of time for that. Now, as a result, this court would then remand the case to the district court for consideration of the two surviving issues, which are the effectiveness of appellate post-conviction counsel, GG, for failing to perfect his appeal, as well as the effectiveness of post-conviction counsel, ML, in failing to raise the multitude of claims that he feels should have been raised.
So, Ms. Fettigy, going back, pardon me, no. Got a frog in my throat, sorry. Going back to those claims, those are the three claims that we were just talking about, right? That ML theoretically should have raised, right? You didn't get the notes. You didn't, you know, because the hat's missing, it should have filed a motion for destruction of the evidence, and the third one is should have gotten a ballistics expert. Those are the three that we're talking about.
Correct.
What if the trial court was right when it said nope, record establishes that he's not entitled to relief? Just hypothetically, if the trial court was right when it did that, do we have to do any of this?
Well, then it ends there. So essentially, you start with the appellate post-conviction counsel, which, let's say we remand on that issue first, decide that the district court has to find both deficient performance by GG and prejudice. Now, it seems like pursuant to Baker, ineffective performance will be fairly easily found. However, that's not up to me to speculate. Obviously, the district court has to make those findings. And as to prejudice, all that the defendant would have to show is that the defendant, there was a reasonable probability that but for counsel's deficient failure to perfect his appeal, he would have timely appealed. So it seems at a minimum that the defendant will have his right to appeal the first case reinstated. So that's like the first layer.
And but well, what I'm saying, layer. What I'm saying is, what if we just basically conduct that review? We do that. We look at that first order and evaluate it.
Because I believe that there needs to be further a record development in this case. These are ineffective assistance of counsel claims, and to the extent that we need to work backwards from the time when the defendant filed his second 35C, figure out what went wrong in the first instance, then continue backwards and continue backwards, because you may not even have to get there. Let's say, you know, GG, while it doesn't seem like that's the case on this record and on the facts that we have as of now, let's say that, hypothetically speaking, in some sort of evidentiary hearing, GG comes forward and says, you know, I told the defendant that I wasn't going to be able to represent him. I was going to Iraq, and that I, you know, would not be, you know, furthering his appeal from this point on. Now, you know, if that were to happen, then there was no error here. There was no failure to perfect his appeal because maybe he knew it. Now, I'm just obviously hypothesizing at this point.
But perhaps I'm belaboring the obvious, but the real nut here is that there was not appellate review of that first order, right? That's the substantive nut,
correct?
Right? That's where the real issues were hashed out, and the issue is, did the trial court err when it did this without a hearing, right?
Yes.
If we address that issue in this case, first of all, I want to know, can we? But if we do address that issue in this case, doesn't the defendant get what he would have gotten had GG filed his notice of appeal?
Yes. So here's my reasons why you should not address it right now.
Okay.
First, that would require, I mean, to the extent that the defendant now wants these cases consolidated and all the issues addressed, you know, the problem with this is that it flies in the face of a lot of procedural rules. And I think that in order to make this case fit into all of our appellate rules, post-conviction, you know, proceedings, those kinds of things, we need to take this step by step as opposed to just throwing everything out there. So the reasons why we shouldn't just address everything now is, number one, this case was never properly consolidated. Pursuant to the Colorado Appellate Rules 3C and 27, you have to go through the motion process. There has to be an opportunity to either stipulation or the opportunity to file a response. None of that was done here, so we would be, you know, obviously working in violation of those two rules. Second, this would raise some serious jurisdictional issues because by granting the notice of appeal in 0893, this court was essentially taking jurisdiction over the defendant's case from the district court. However, when you think about it, this court already had jurisdiction over the defendant's case when it accepted the appeal in 1304. So, because it stems from the same district court case. So while the scope of the appeal may have been slightly different, the issue of jurisdiction is something this court, you know, it's going to be problematic because you're essentially turning the light on twice. How do you have more jurisdiction than you already had? And that's the whole problem with having the simultaneous appeals, is that they don't, anything you do in one is going to affect the other, which is why we don't have two appeals in the same case. We're dealing with the same defendant, same district court case, and for all intents and purposes, the same order, with the first 35C. The denial of the first 35C is what it all boils down to, as Judge Bernard points out.
What if we just consolidated?
Well, that's my argument, is that we shouldn't consolidate because, number one, the defendant never filed that motion, but also...
Well, so what? Why? I mean, is there anything jurisdictionally that prohibits us from doing that on our own?
Well, what I just mentioned was the issue of, you know, jurisdiction, because you already had it, and so I feel that in order to fully address all the issues, you should work backwards. And also, the people don't agree that awarding an untimely appeal 4 years out of time, while the defendant already has a post-conviction appeal pending, is necessarily going to serve the best interest of this court either. You're kind of opening a door here. As you know, it's a 45-day limit. You can extend it to 30 days upon a showing. People v. Baker obviously allows for good cause, but I think the circumstances here are very different than Baker, in that we're not attempting to preserve the defendant's absolute right to a direct appeal, and the defendant already has a post-conviction, this is my point, the post-conviction appeal, he's already getting that, and he's going to get there just in step-by-step order. So he's going to get review. It's very likely he will get review of that first order, but let's just do it step-by-step so that we're not flying in the face of all these procedural rules.
So what we do is if we follow what you want us to do, we dismiss this one, we send it back down, and then, according to you, it returns to us again, and it's then that we look at it?
Well, with a developed record. Now, remember, we're going to be sending it back, number one, on the issue of post-conviction appellate counsel, but also on the ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel, ML.
But what about claimed ineffectiveness of trial counsel, which is the subject, as I understand it, of the 08 appeal? Where is that in all of this?
Well, that will also get addressed, I think, in finding the ineffectiveness or considering the ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel. Can say they do find her to be ineffective, the remedy is then to open up to all of the 35C claims from the first post-conviction motion as supplemented. In fact, the defendant could even supplement and consider them all, you know, at an evidentiary hearing at that point in time.
So Ms. Pettigrew, I guess what I've been trying to propose, I think, is the appellant equivalent of Alexander's solution for the Gordian knot. Do you know what that was?
I'm sorry.
The Gordian knot was a very, very complicated knot that Alexander the Great came upon during his conquerings. Okay. And he was asked to unravel it so that he could become emperor. And people had tried for hundreds of years and been unable to do so. Alexander took one look at the knot, pulled out his sword, chopped it in half, and said, "I win." So I'm not trying to suggest that as an exercise of raw power that we do that. What I am using that analogy is to suggest that perhaps this is one of those cases where, to cut through all the procedural confusion, maybe what we need to do is to get to where Mr. Gilkey's case really matters, which is to go back and take a look at that first 35C and determine whether that first 35C order should be upheld or not.
In other words, swapping out. So would you propose then to eliminate consideration of 1304? Because essentially you're saying the remedy to 1304 is to consider the appeal in 0893.
Yeah, that would be the remedy.
Well, in that instance, but you would be doing so without any developed record, which, you know, it seems.
But we'd have the record that exists for the 35C, unless you're telling me that it would be wrong to do that because there is a reasonable chance that we would find that GG was not ineffective when he didn't file his appeal.
I'm just not speculating either way. I believe that it's the trial court's place to develop those facts on the record, make factual findings from which then you, as an appellate court, you know, considers and makes your findings from those more substantive, from a more substantive position where you can make an informed decision. At this point, you know, as both, you know, defense counsel and I have conceded, this record is, you know, a pretty big mess, and we have a lot of discrepancies. We've had so many irregularities. My concern is that this court, in slicing through the knot, will, in essence, kind of start tumbling down this hill that won't be able to come back from procedurally, in terms of, you know, why not just take it back little by little, step by step, unravel the knot, and then when we get to the answer, you may find that the answer is much sooner found than we all think, but we won't know that until a record on these issues is developed, is the people's position. And we feel that it is the district court's place to do that, not the appellate court's.
All right. Thank you. All right. So that is the end of the oral argument on 08 CA 893. At this point, what I'll do, we can start on 07 CA 1304 and see where this takes us in light of where the argument has been. So, Ms. Rodenberg.
Thank you. Now, the 07 appeal, the first appeal, is the appeal of the second order. And the best way to address that, I think, is to answer Judge Bernard's question. And that is, well, why don't you just review the first order on its merits, and then do we even need the second appeal? Do we even need to go there? And here's why you do. It's because the 08 appeal of the 2004 order doesn't address all of these additional issues, such as the ineffective assistance of Ms. Bass for failure to raise certain appellate issues, for failure to do the 35B, and the ineffective assistance of ML. So one of two things either happened in that district court order in 2004. Either the district court didn't make findings of fact and conclusions of law regarding Ms. Bass, regarding those issues, or ML was ineffective in abandoning them. I can't quite tell from the way this record exists which of those two is the more correct way to kind of describe that. But clearly, the court's order in 2004 did not address any of those issues, and they were clearly either raised or should have been raised.
Let me ask you a question, because I know that the ineffectiveness of appellate or post-conviction counsel may go back to the initial issue of the ineffectiveness of trial counsel in the first instance. And what I guess I'm still not clear on then is, are you saying that the court did not address each of the allegations that were raised against trial counsel before we even get to post-conviction and appellate? Because my understanding, there's a pro se motion, and then you stated that it was supplemented by post-conviction counsel, but were all the issues before the court or only some of the issues before the court, and did the court address each of those, and what were they?
Well, pro se motion is so confusing, all of them are. But the only possible issue I can possibly come up with that he raised pro se or alluded to pro se in that first motion regarding trial counsel that was not addressed in the 2004 order was the failure to raise speedy trial because of the 8-year lag between his arrest and the alleged incident.
All right, so then the other issues regarding trial counsel were the three you identified on appeal with regard to the preliminary hearing, failure to hire an expert, and failure to litigate a destruction of evidence motion.
Right.
Okay.
And that's why, in many ways, I think the 2007 appeal is the most important one, because that's got all of these issues that we really do need a remand on. Now, if this court addresses on the merits, a review of the 2004 order, regardless of which way it goes, then any possible ineffectiveness of Mr. G for not properly perfecting that appeal in time is moot. And that's where I disagree with the Attorney General on, because I think that if you do review the 2004 order on its merits, at least the issues that the district court raised, that, you know, it just doesn't matter whether, you know, there's nothing else that Mr. G did or failed to do at this point that would become relevant. We would solely be dealing with a remand to flesh out the record on the potential ineffectiveness or incompetence of Ms. Bass and Ms. L, the post-conviction counsel in district court.
So I understand what you're saying now is that you wouldn't be able to show prejudice for Mr. G not filing the appeal if this court accepted the appeal, because Mr. Gilkey gets the appeal that he was seeking in the first instance. All right. So then my next question with regard to Ms. B is there were allegations against her regarding what she failed to raise on appeal, in addition to the separate issue of did she file a 35B motion seeking reduction of sentence?
Right.
All right, was there anything else?
Well, there's kind of this other issue that's hovering around in there that wasn't, I don't know how well that was raised below, but given the Supreme Court ruling that came years later, there's a clear issue has been raised as to her competence to practice law and whether she was competent at that time, and therefore whether Mr. Gilkey was denied his constitutional right to effective assistance of appellate counsel, and whether the remedy then is to just start over on the direct appeal. And I think, though, that record needs to be made in the district court through expert witnesses, and it's going to be pretty contentious, and we're going to have to try to, kind of after the fact, try to construct what was going on with Ms. B. And it might turn out that regardless of whether she had provable mental health issues or not, it might just come down to whether her performance fell below the standard of care and therefore prejudiced Mr. Gilkey. But those are all kind of interrelated issues upon which there's no record yet. And again, why the 2004 order is insufficient to completely dispose of the merits of the first 35C, because the district court failed to even address the issue of ineffective assistance of Ms. B, which was raised in some respect in that very confusing and rambling pro se motion by, you know, this barely literate defendant.
What's the legal basis? What's the main argument for your contention in the 07 case that the court erred by denying the 2005 35C motion based, I guess, on timeliness and successiveness, right? Never got to the merits, correct?
Right.
So what's the core of your legal argument as to why the court erred?
It wasn't time barred because there is no time bar for a Silva type Rule 35C. For some reason, the Arapahoe County District Courts have decided that if you're going to raise ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, you must do so within 3 years of the first order, but that doesn't say that anywhere.
That's what I understand the AG to be agreeing with you.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And it's not successive either, because either these issues of Ms. B's ineffectiveness were somehow abandoned by Ms. L, and therefore her ineffective assistance could not have been raised by her. That's the new issue that's not successive. Or the district court never properly ruled on it in the first place when it issued its 2004 order. And so there needs to be a remand for the district court then to dispose of all issues that were raised in the first motion.
Druttenberg, if I may. The three-year time bar for statutory time bar for raising ineffectiveness has to do in the first instance with the constitutional right to counsel. Thus, if I am convicted and within 3 years I file my 35C, I am fine, and I can argue that my constitutional right to counsel or on appeal was denied, right? You say that there is no time bar for Silva. Now, that makes that I'm wondering where you get that, because we're talking about, as Silva made clear, a limited statutory right to counsel. So why would the burden on a constitutional right be 3 years, but the burden on a statutory, limited statutory right be non-existent?
Well, because the statute, and I believe that's
16.5402,
it only that's a statute that sets forth the time bar. There's nothing in the Colorado Constitution that sets forth the time bar. So it's the statute that's setting forth this time bar to raise all these constitutional issues. And then Silva came through later and said, well, then you also have the right, a limited statutory right to effective assistance of post-conviction counsel that's the same constitutional test under Strickland, but
it's a constitutional test applied in a statutory context, and I think that's an important distinction,
right?
Because we're not talking about a constitutional deprivation.
But my point is, nowhere in 16.5402 does it discuss that kind of civil right to effective assistance of post-conviction counsel.
So
our case law yet.
Are you suggesting then that what Silva did is create a never-ending revolving door of opportunities to argue ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel so that the case is never final?
Well, the case is going to be final someday, because sooner or later you're going to be barred by laches. I mean, the doctrine of laches still applies. It has to be raised within a reasonable time limit. And I think Mr. Gilkey, given the fact that he was incarcerated and is barely literate and was trying to do this by himself, did raise these issues within a reasonable time after he found out that he'd been abandoned by Mr. G and wasn't going to get this appeal. But again, that's a finding of fact that I think has to be made by the trial court.
But let me ask you a little bit about Silva then, because I know that Silva recognizes there's a statutory right to post-conviction counsel, not a constitutional right, and it also recognizes that a defendant may raise ineffective claims, and Strickland is the standard, the constitutional standard for effective assistance of counsel. But so my understanding then is what it leaves unanswered is whether there's a time bar that applies to those claims. I understand that Ms. Bettigieu is saying it's a reasonable time. And does that come out of the cases, or do you know of any authority that has even addressed what is the time limit to challenge post-conviction?
There is no case yet that specifically addresses that issue. It's certainly been implied by Silva that it should be reasonable. The cases like Valdez that are dealing with the laches issue certainly would mandate that it be raised within a reasonable amount of time. And I think this whole issue of how far this constitutional right for post-conviction counsel goes also is dependent on what the United States Supreme Court does in the upcoming Martinez case, which has not been ruled on yet. But that could completely change this analysis depending on how the United States Supreme Court rules in that case. If the United States Supreme Court case finds that there is a constitutional right to post-conviction counsel to raise the constitutional ineffectiveness of trial counsel, I think that could possibly change the analysis in Silva. But that's probably an issue for another day, but I could see how that could impact this case, especially if this case gets remanded for findings of fact regarding ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. I do have a couple minutes left over. I can reserve this time if the court has no further questions for me. Okay.
Hello again, Corral Spettigieu, Attorney General for, I represent the people in this matter, registration number 39208. I'm just going to briefly, as the court knows, I've sort of touched on most of my positions in the previous argument, and so to the extent that you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt me. I wanted to just address a couple of things that that we talked about, or that defense counsel just spoke about. First of all, again, defense counsel also pointed to the fact that she couldn't tell from the record whether or not the speedy trial issue was raised in the first 35C or some of these ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claims. I just wanted to clarify a little bit for this court. From my recollection of the record, and granted it's been, about a year since I've reviewed this interesting record, Judge Lichtenstein, you were correct. The defendant filed a pro se 35C, and then over a year later, ML supplemented this 35C, and it's unclear whether, she meant to abandon all of the previous claims raised by the defendant or what happened, but it seems like the district court only considered the supplement and not the defendant's 35C claims. So to the extent that he may want to address those at some further juncture, again, my solution of working backwards would give him access to those claims again should post-conviction counsel be found to have been ineffective. But again, it would take the steps to get there because at this juncture, it would seem that those claims are abandoned and this court wouldn't be able to consider them. If post-conviction counsel, ML, was found to be ineffective, then pretty much the door is open again to all his 35C claims. He can re-raise them, an evidentiary hearing can be held, and the record can be developed at that point in time. So I think that's an important note to be considered by this court in terms of which appeal to dismiss and or to dismiss one, et cetera.
I'm still trying to get my hands on what each of you want us to do, quite frankly. So let's start with you first.
Okay.
You want us to dismiss the 08 appeal.
Yes.
So, and if I'm hearing Ms. Ruttenberg right, she wants us to reverse the 2004 order so that the district court can hold an evidentiary hearing on the claims asserted in that 2004 order.
Well, I think part of the problem is if we just go straight to the 08 CA 0893 case, the 04 order, number one, she's going to miss out on the post-conviction counsel claims and these 35A claims that were raised in the second 35C motion, which...
But you've already... Why would she miss out on those? Because aren't you agreeing that those should all go back?
Well, I'm saying that those should be remanded for further findings.
Okay, but I'm not talking about the 04 order. and you want us to dismiss it. So if we dismiss it, what, where is it in the universe? I mean, we dismiss the
appeal. If this, essentially what would happen is you would pretend like this court never granted the notice of appeal in 2008, whatever it was, when 4 years out of time, this court granted the notice of appeal. Instead, we would proceed as if this defendant's post-conviction appellate counsel failed to file a notice of appeal, and he files that grievance by filing a second 35C. It comes all the way up here, and you guys say, you know, this was not proper. We need to go back down for an evidentiary hearing on that issue. The court will, you know, do its duty to find whether or not there was ineffective assistance and prejudice, which the people are saying is very likely to happen, but we don't know. An evidentiary hearing needs to be held on that issue. If that's the case, then the remedy would be to potentially reinstate his notice of appeal in this case. However, because he also raised the ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel, or ML, that hearing would also take place. And so the court can then pursue, you know, an evidentiary hearing on and develop a record on that issue. And if ML is found to be ineffective, then it opens the door to all his 35C claims from the first motion. And so what I'm saying is we're working backwards as we would had this court never granted the notice of appeal in 08.
So I have two questions for you. The first is, you're saying there's no sword here.
I'm sorry?
You're saying there's no sword here.
Sword.
As in Alexander's.
Correct.
Okay.
I'm saying for this court's own procedural practice, I feel that this is a better way of unraveling the, I mean, we can all admit that this case is a complete mess when it comes to procedurally, the record, everything. And so I think it behooves this court to let the district court kind of unravel its own mess, figure it out a little bit, and then send it back if necessary. And I think to the extent that it will preserve the appellate rules, the post-conviction practice, and the defendant's own claims, we should kind of let these remedies flow as they're meant to do. This is why it's set up the way it is. And so if we kind of circumvent this and cut these corners, I'm a little concerned that this is going to open some doors and that the defendant is sort of reaping benefits that he may or may not deserve.
So if we were to dismiss the 08 appeal, and then Ms. Ruttenberg or some other lawyer on the defendant's behalf comes into the trial court and says, okay, we're back here. The very first thing I want is an evidentiary hearing on my 04 motion. What's the district attorney going to say about that?
Well, I mean, I would say that this court would have to send it back with pretty specific directions as to what the evidentiary hearing, at least the initial ones, will be pertaining to, or at least the scope.
So what's your position? If we dismiss the appeal, do we even have the authority to say, please conduct an evidentiary hearing on the 2004?
Well, it's not on the order. It's on the effectiveness of appellate post-conviction counsel.
No, I'm talking about ineffectiveness of trial counsel, which is what the subject of the 08 order is.
But you don't get there until we hash out the first two issues of effectiveness.
Why not?
Post-conviction counsel.
Why not?
Because, well, first of all, there's successiveness and abandonment issues that, so he raised them in his first post-conviction motion. Let me get this out. Okay. In his pro se motion, he raises trial and appellate counsel ineffectiveness claims. Then in the supplement, she raises these very specific ineffectiveness of trial counsel claims, but doesn't really address anything on the appellate counsel issue. The district court only pretty much relying on the people's motion, which if my recollection serves me, only addressed the ineffectiveness of trial counsel. So he's essentially foreclosed on the appellate counsel issue at this point, if we were just to send it back on the district court as is. Now, if we do it the way that I'm suggesting, by first allowing the ineffectiveness of post-conviction and post-conviction appellate counsel, say those two are found to be ineffective, he's going to get a second shot at all of those claims. And, you know, I'm not willing to speculate that it will go one way or the other, but he's got a good shot because, you know, the facts of this case are just so convoluted. So to the extent that I believe this is the best way to preserve the most of his, you know, the majority of his claims and allow the district court to actually make findings on the record, I think this is the way to go.
Well, let me ask you one question, because I know you're concerned with the jurisdictional piece of this. We have had cases where we have expanded the scope of our appeal to include motions that have been filed subsequent to a notice of appeal. So would we have the same concern if we had the 07 case and expanded the scope of that to include, it would be the 04 motion?
Correct. Unfortunately, I didn't brief that issue. And so to the extent that it just seems problematic to me that the court would have jurisdiction over a case, have an appeal before it of this district court order, and then, would grant a second appeal of that same order simultaneously, having to deal with both when both kind of affect the outcome in the other. And so while scope, I guess, would be a simple way to maybe consider it, I don't know that it's that easy, because the remedies and the way that these issues kind of are all intertwined from the first motion to the second motion, I don't know that it's going to be that simple in terms of, if we just, open up the scope, then we would be able to hash this out. So, I would be happy, again, to do a supplemental briefing on the issue, but I think it might be a little more complicated than just the scope idea. If there are no further questions, I'm going to rely on my briefs and on the arguments of today and ask that this court dismiss 08-CA-0893, remand the case in 07-CA-1304 to the district court on the issues of the effectiveness of post-conviction appellate counsel and post-conviction counsel.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Redenberg, you have 2 minutes and 27 seconds.
Okay, I want to address the issue of whether or not it makes sense to dismiss the 08 appeal, because if you do it my way, you'll end up with so much more easier way to proceed in the district court, because if you rule on the merits of the 08 appeal and don't reverse your prior order granting the notice of appeal out of time and acknowledging you had jurisdiction to do so, then on those three issues that were addressed by the district court, you'll either rule yes or no, we should have had an evidentiary hearing, and then if you rule no, that he wasn't entitled to an evidentiary hearing, those issues are done forever. And then we'll just deal with whether the district court erred in failing to address the other issues raised in the pro se motion by failing to do findings of fact and conclusions of law on those motions. And additionally, then the district court never has to take up the issue of Mr. G's ineffectiveness, because it will be moot, and we can only concentrate then in the district court on whether or not Ms. L was ineffective for either not raising a bunch of issues, impliedly abandoning these issues, not objecting to the way the district attorney kind of limited the issues over her objection, all of those various issues that were then raised in the 2005 or in the second 35C and not addressed by the district court in this 2005 order. So that's why I'm asking you to do it this other way.
I have some empathy for Ms. Bettigue's unintended consequences response to my Alexander's sword hypothetical. What are there unintended consequences that we could end up creating bad procedural precedent here if we do what you ask us to do?
Not if it's an unpublished case. Only if it's a published case. So just don't publish it. And then it's definitely just limited to this case, and no one's ever going to be able to cite to it.
Well, you realize you're jumping into a very, very controversial pit, like you're saying.
Yes. And to be clear, we wouldn't publish it to bury it. Our work basically is accessible to the public, and we wouldn't do something to hide a decision, just to be clear.
But of course, but the way the court rules are, if you had an unpublished decision in this case that somebody else could say, well, there's unintended consequences in all these other cases, nobody's allowed to cite to it. So the chance of that happening is pretty remote.
Thank you, Ms. Redenberg. All right, the cases will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments, and the bailiff may call a recess.